For better or for worse, a lot of home improvement projects are clearly visible. You see a water leak coming through your ceiling, or maybe you got a sagging gutter or a cracked driveway. It's pretty easy to spot, of course. There's an issue, though, with your house insulation. If there is one, it can be a little harder to pinpoint. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. And we're visiting today with John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates in Fitchburg. He's going to share what he knows about keeping your home in good shape and how to save money at the same time. And John, thanks for coming by.
Glad to be here again, Larry.
Really appreciate having you with us. I want to talk a little bit about insulation to begin with. Insulation has several purposes, does it not, really?
Well, its main purpose is to offer resistance to thermal loss.
Okay.
Way back when we had our first houses, let's say we had a nice old house in 1400, you know, it was timber frame with some bricks and wattle and daub, and there was no insulation in that. All we had was the mass of the house, and, you know, it slowed down the heat from leaving through the mud and things. But when we got into the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, we started discovering that there were materials that were good for keeping the heat in or keeping the heat out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we developed what was really called insulation.
And the types of insulation, of course, that's varied over time. What are the types that are typically used today?
Well, used today, again, it's highly variable, Larry. We've got all kinds of plastics that we're using, extruded, expanded products. We're spray-in-place urethanes. We have sheet products. We have urethane sheet products with heat mirrors on them. Older houses, we see a lot of cellulose that was used, and that's one mm-hmm. of the first things that we discovered that really works. So we'll have the old tar impregnated 3/4 inch or inch thick exterior sheathing that is on the house.
Mm-hmm.
We see a lot of things. Even in old houses like my 1850s house, they already knew that dead air spaces produced resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started redoing some of my house, I found that in the middle of the stud walls, I took the plaster off the inside, there's another layer of plaster in the middle of the wall. And so it divided that 4-inch interstitial space into two spaces. Now, the 4-inch space was worth R1. The two spaces were worth R2.
Well, you know, this goes back years, but I an old farmhouse that I rented, you know, way, way back, there was some work done on it, and opened up the wall, and there was old newspapers where the insulation was old newspapers from 1920-something.
Well, certainly. You're lucky it wasn't corn husks, because we've seen that as well. And, of course, newspapers we still use. It's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Is you take your State Journal and your Cap Times, you send it to the recycler, and they grind it up. They cover it with a fire treatment. And then we use it in our walls and our attics, and we get we get about R3 per inch out of discarded newspaper. So that old farmer knew something.
Well, is there a best product to use?
No, there are products that have higher and lower R values, mm-hmm. but you have to be a little bit careful about what you use. Let's take this old stone farmhouse here,
okay.
Stone foundation farmhouse you lived in. So we've got this stone, and the stone gets wet, and it transfers moisture upward. Now, the best thing possible to use in a ring joist generally is a spray urethane. The problem is the spray urethane is an air barrier, and it's a moisture barrier. So what that would do is that would have a tendency to trap moisture.
Oh.
So there we might want to use fiberglass, which isn't as good R per inch, but it breathes. So if some moisture came up out of that stone and got into the wood, it would dry. So we really need to look at houses as living, breathing machines. We almost need to look at them like animals, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Because they shed moisture, they breathe in and they breathe out, and they develop heat through their furnaces, and they try to retain that.
You know, you have talked on this program in the past about energy audits, and an energy audit can really help us determine what we need in the way of additional insulation, does it not?
Well, and not just insulation, Larry. A lot of the importance of an energy audit is that blower door test.
Yeah.
Because if you take a look at the heat loss from houses, very often it is the air leaks. It's the infiltration of cold air and the exfiltration of warm air. But when you cover up that door and turn that fan on and depressurize the house to 50 pascals and then read how fast that air is coming in to make up for what's going out. It gives you an idea how many air changes, and you have houses that will have a dozen air changes in an hour.
Ooh.
You know, versus a modern, when we get to these new homes, like these homes that are more or less passive, we're looking at half an air change per hour, and much of that will be mechanically ventilated. So think of reducing air changes by a factor of 24 to achieve efficiency. That is a big, big factor. And the only way to really find that out is to go ahead and do a blower door test.
So you've done that blower door test. Who's the best type of person to call about installing or replacing insulation?
Well, an insulation contractor, but often you'll have to work with a general contractor. And again, this is going to depend upon the age and the type of the house you have. What I suggest to people when they buy a house or if they start thinking about this for an existing house is put together either a 5-year or a 10-year plan. So let's say you've got this vinyl siding and it's looking pretty crummy. And you're thinking, in the next 5 years, I'm going to get rid of that vinyl siding. Well, when you do, that gives you a great opportunity to wrap the exterior of that house in a wind and water barrier and to add foam insulation on the exterior of that house before you put on the new siding. So think about these things in advance. Come up with a multi-year plan. Start with that plan by getting the house evaluated. List what the problems are and when is the best time to fix those problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when would be? Probably summertime?
One can really work on a house in Wisconsin nowadays all during the year. Yes. Now, the energy audits I like to do in the winter.
Oh, because, absolutely.
Well, I like thermal imaging.
Yeah.
You can do thermal imaging in the summer, but boy, you've got to be a genius to read it because sometimes the images, you know, your house has air conditioning, Larry. So if you read it in the summer, we're probably going to find that the areas in the winter that would look cold are going to look warm in the summer, and it's really like reading a reverse image, which is always difficult.
We had ours done in the winter, and it really does show up then.
It certainly does, and you need somebody with a good quality camera who knows how to read it, and it gives you a way of prioritizing where is the worst loss.
Yeah. We have lots of callers or lots of emailers, and I haven't given the number, so why don't I do that right now? If you have a question for our guest today, John Freiberger, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We've got open lines all the way across. 1-800-642-1234. Email from Wayne in Krakow, wondering if you could discuss passive house standards and possibly why they seem to be so slow to be adopted here in the U.S. as opposed to Germany, I guess.
Well, Germany really seems to be the home of the passive house. The Hamburg houses have been studied now, I think, for a good 6 years or so, and we keep looking at the studies. Adopting a standard versus doing something is really different, because adopting a standard for a passive house, let's say we put it into the code, would really raise the price of houses.
Mm.
And what we're looking at with a passive house is we're looking at super insulation and super air barriers. As I said earlier, we're looking at houses where the air change is only about one half per hour. That is one change per 2 hours, which is very little air change plus very little radiant loss.
Because of the amount of insulation and
and because of how tightly it's sealed. Now, Larry, let's say you live in a passive house and you turn on the hood fan and then you turn on the dryer. Well, they're not going to work. Yeah. You actually have to introduce makeup air for everything that is exhausting when you have a passive house. So that means if I'm designing a passive house for you, I'm going to take all your bathroom exhaust fans, I'm going to put them through either heat recovery or energy recovery ventilation system. If you have a hood fan in your kitchen, because I know you like to cook, I'm going to, depending upon the size of it, either have tempered, untempered, or both types of air coming in. And depending upon the size of the fan, I'm going to have it come in at two different locations.
Wow.
So you start running into mechanical, the need for mechanical sophistication that you just don't need in a house. As my friend Joe Stilbrick used to say, the solution to pollution is dilution. And all of our houses get polluted just because we're living in it, because of the urethane in the walls, the formaldehyde in the couch cushions is coming out. So we need these air changes. In a passive house, we've got to mechanically introduce those air changes, and we have to make sure it's balanced.
Wow. A lot to think about there. Don and DePere says, my family and I live in an older split-level home. The bedrooms are at the top level. In my son's bedroom closet, there's an access to the attic, which consists of a panel in the ceiling. I've not used this access, but it seems his closet is always colder or warmer than the rest of his room. I have to assume it's because of poor insulation or the lack. I have not opened up this panel, as to do so means moving most of what my son has in the closet. And it's amazing what's in there. He said, what should I find in regards to insulation on this panel, and what would you suggest I use to insulate the panel?
The current, if you look at the current Uniform Dwelling Code for Wisconsin, Larry, I believe that that panel needs to be insulated to R19 as a minimum. So that's for the worst case scenario would be R19. The easy way to insulate panels is often to use layers of foam that are basically glued to the drywall or the plywood or whatever the panel is. But the other thing to remember is this, you really want to weather strip this as well. Because if you have it well insulated, but yet your attic, because it's got too many high vents and not enough low vents, creates low pressure area and sucks air out of his son's closet, it's very important that we try to keep an air seal on that as well.
Makes good sense. Bonnie in Duluth, Minnesota, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. My son is looking at purchasing an older home in Minneapolis. And we noticed that a lot of the homes are 1.5 stories. And I'm wondering if he should stay away from 1.5 story home, because it doesn't seem like there is, some of the homes they have a skylight in, and it doesn't look like there's much room between the ceiling of the second story and the roof. So there can't be much insulation or room to put insulation there.
Bonnie, I'm assuming when you say a story and a half, you mean like a Cape Cod sort of house where part of the second floor has...
They're kind of like a craftsman. They're from 1910, 1925.
Sure, area. Yes. And many of those, you're right, many of those, the roof framing is only 2x4s. Okay. And if you leave an inch space in there and then try to insulate, even with the best stuff out there, like a spray-in-place urethane... With that 2.5-inch airspace, well, you're only up about R20. And, boy, in Minneapolis, that's not much. Now, there are some ways that we have worked on these houses.
Okay.
We've worked on craftsman bungalows. We've worked on mid-century moderns, you know, the 1955 houses. They have all the cathedral ceilings.
Yeah.
And they only have the rafters and the interstitial spaces.
Sure.
And what we've done is we've put energy panels on the roof. So here's where we talked earlier about this 5 or 10 year planning. Let's hope that the house he's looking at has worn out shingles and doesn't have a brand new roof. Because that way, as part of the roofing program, those shingles can come off, they can insulate that rafter space, and then they can put panels, energy panels, over the top of the roof. The energy panels come with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 inches of foam, whatever you need, and then a nailing surface for the shingles. You build up the fascia, but you can produce an R50 roof system with them. There is a brand made right here in Wisconsin by the Cornell Company, and they do have a website. I think if you just Google Cornell Company Wisconsin or Cornell Energy Panels, you will see the different types of panels that are available. Lots of companies make them, but I always like to refer people to Wisconsin companies if possible.
Sure. Right.
So there are indeed solutions.
Is that very expensive to do?
Yes. It certainly isn't cheap. But what we need to do when we think about insulating a house is we've got to look at our payback.
Right.
And we have to also look to see if there's any energy credits available, too. Now, I know Wisconsin. I know Focus on Energy. I don't know anything about Minneapolis.
Sure.
So one's going to have to look for the Minnesota version of Focus on Energy and see what might be available. But what he'll want to do is get the heating bills for this house and the air conditioning bills.
Right. That's what I suggested to him.
If he can save, let's say he can save $700, $800, $900 a year, and this ends up adding $10,000 to the cost, well, that's sort of like buying a 9% savings bond. That would actually be a pretty good investment, even though it is expensive. And certainly it's going to add value to that house as well as livability.
Right, Right. Yeah, it's like I said, it's the majority of the homes. I'm at home here looking online for him, and the majority of them are 1.5 stories. It was really surprising to me.
Yeah. Well, got some good advice there from John. I hope you can help him follow it, Bonnie. Thank you very much for calling. John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates Fitchburg, our guest today as we talk with him about saving money and energy here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And when you call in, Judith Sears Poisson answers with her normal, friendly voice. It's a great voice. It's a great voice. And you're great listeners. Thanks for listening here on the Ideas Network. Right now, talking about your home with general contractor John Freiberger. And John, lots of calls, lots of emails. I had an email from Lisa. Here's one I know you're going to have some experience with. Lisa says, I had a couple contractors quote on spray insulating my horse pole barn. And John is big in horses here. So they both recommended closed cell foam. I would line the interior walls with liner sheet metal. There are some small leaks now, and I do periodically get condensation from the animals. Would the insulation stop water from penetrating the walls? Would it stop the condensation? My husband's concerned if I had this done, it would lock the moisture into the wall and rot the wood.
Well, here's a question we could spend half an hour on, Larry, but we won't because we have more listeners waiting. Horses produce a tremendous amount of condensation. Even our large dogs produce a lot of condensation. So we will end up with very high relative humidity in the winter and inside of horse barns. If one is going to insulate well, one has to really try to figure out what the inside temperature of the metal panel she's planning to line the interior with is going to be, whether it is going to be what's called a first condensing surface or not. And to do that, you're going to actually have to look at a chart that shows you relative humidity versus temperature. And then you have to try to design that wall to maintain a certain temperature. Now, she didn't say whether this is a heated barn or not. If this is a heated barn, I would think it would be since she's insulating it.
Yeah.
It's certainly going to be a lot better than if this is an unheated barn and relying upon the body heat of the horses to keep it warm. Having an interior vapor barrier is going to have to be is going to be extremely important. The foam insulation sprayed in, as we said earlier, is a vapor barrier itself, but where it meets those the treated posts, there we have a spot where the posts are going to be colder because of thermal bridging. And if air gets in there, we're going to get condensation on those posts. So everything in that interior of that barn is going to have to be covered very, very carefully. The other thing that they should probably do is they should be putting a wind barrier on the exterior as well. Because if we do get some pressure differentials, that can also force moisture into the walls. The mechanical system should include a way of producing air changes. So I'll leave it there, Larry. There's a lot of things to consider because this is even more difficult than a house because there's more condensation coming off of these large animals.
And you've had lots of experience with those large animals.
I do, Larry, and I'm continuously experimenting with my horse barn because I want to add more insulation. And I keep going, how am I really going to do this? So I am going to do a ceiling area this winter. I'm going to cover it with plywood. I'm going to see how it works. So I'm going to do the calculations very carefully. So maybe by next summer, we do this program again, I'll be a little bit more informed from a practical point of view.
Chris in Oshkosh has a question for you. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going, John and Larry?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, great, great. I recently bought a home, and with it came this massive garage, which was actually a big selling point for me. But I'm planning to put a car lift in it, and then I guess I'd like to have it be an area where I can do work in the winter. And essentially, it has, you know, studs and an outside, I guess, almost like a cedar siding. But I wonder, I guess, what kind of foam might, or I guess what kind of, insulation should I be using? If there are, I see like maybe one or two, like a few in a couple areas, maybe like little pinholes where I can like see sunlight or something. And I was thinking of going around and maybe closing those, caulking them or something. But ultimately, I guess if water were to get into something like that, what am I, I guess, do I then need to put drywall on that? And on the, once I do insulate, I guess I kind of got a lot of questions, but, and do I need a permit to do any of that stuff?
The permit part I really can't answer for you. It depends upon where you live. Some cities, like the city of Madison, you would need a permit. Some places in the country, the Uniform Dwelling Code has been adopted only for new buildings or for additions, not for repairs and remodeling. So check with your local jurisdiction that has authority, city, township, or some places even the county. Now, I'm going to just give you some real general considerations. The best thing to use that I really like is the spray two-part urethane. What's nice about it is, repeating again, that it not only gives you good thermal resistance, about R6.2, R6 per inch, but it also gives you an air barrier and a water barrier. So those little pinholes that you see, you're not going to get air infiltration.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that if you're going to be working in this garage and you're going to be sealing it, you want to seal the wall with the house as well. So you may even want to spray foam that to seal it well. But once we do this, this wall cannot dry very well. So if the cedar siding is not in good condition, and if there isn't a good water barrier on the outside and some water gets pulled into the wall system, it's not going to dry very well. So we could end up with decaying studs in the framing. So you want to make sure that your outside envelope is secure before you go ahead and do this. If you do put on a urethane foam, I always do suggest covering it with plywood or with a cheaper sheetrock.
Yep.
Part of that is simply because of the flame spread. Is even though it's in a garage, if something happened, you want to make sure that this stuff does not catch on fire because it will burn very quickly. So I would go ahead and cover the interior as well. But you should be able to produce a garage that has pretty limited heat loss. You don't want to have air exchange with the house. And then you should be able to heat it with a small unit heater or something that is adequately vented to the outside.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck, Chris. Thanks for calling. Marty in Fox Valley, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, John. You kind of actually touched upon one of the things that I'm concerned about. We are in the process of looking at options to build a home along the south shore of Lake Superior. And our concern is obviously 60, 65-mile pitch across across the lake and the northwest winds that you obviously get throughout the fall and winter. What do we need to do to really look at ways to protect the house when it comes to wind, when it comes to heat loss?
And, of course, the other part of that is you want windows to be able to look out that way.
That's, as a matter of fact, we're looking at two stories worth of windows there as well, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So the other thing you're going to be looking at is you're going to be looking at a lot of wind bracing. The Wisconsin Code was updated a couple years ago because we had these large houses with large window walls, and they started moving in the wind. And then they moved in the wind and seams opened and then water got in and then the walls rotted. So we re-engineered a bunch of them, some of them only 5 and 6 years old. So when you work with your architect, make sure that they are going to look at the wind bracing of those big scenic view walls that you're going to be putting in. Well, the first thing
we actually talked, go ahead. So we talked to a couple of builders up there and they just kind of gave me a goofy look like, you're doing what, where? So yeah.
Very important. You may actually, if you're going to use builder plans, I would perhaps hire a local professional engineer to take a look at them and see whether they are going to meet the current code. And 80 miles an hour is what you are supposed to design for at this point. 80 miles an hour is 20 pounds per square foot. So take the size of that wall, multiply it by 20, and you'll find tons and tons of force pushing against it. But that's not the real reason you called. The reason you called is on heat loss. Now, fortunately, the area that you're going to be living in, because it's tempered by the lake, actually is a pretty decent climate. So you don't have some of the really intense colds that we find in the interior of Wisconsin. But I would try to exceed the levels that are required by the Uniform Dwelling Code. One thing that everything we're designing right now is taking into account thermal bridging. Now, if you picture a typical stud wall, you've got a stud, insulation, stud, insulation, stud, insulation, all the way around, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that
right.
Insulation might be R26, it might be R30. Well, that stud is not much. That stud is about 1.5 R per inch. So a 6-inch stud is only about R9. So you've got a wall that might be R30, R9, R30, R9, and those studs may make up 10% of the wall, which is then reducing your thermal efficiency of that wall greatly. So what we like to do is either on the interior or the exterior is to have at least 1 inch of foam covering all of the framing to diminish this thermal bridging. This is really quite inexpensive to do, and houses have actually been doing it for quite a few years. The other thing that you want is you want a very good wind barrier. There is a book available. Oh, Larry, I should have I should bring it in so I can never. It's the EEBA out of Minneapolis that has it's a wonderful little book that my friend Joel Stilbrick wrote about how to wrap every type of window and door. And I guess if you email me at frei@chorus.net, I will send you
the information.
I'll send you the information. Larry, I should send it to you, too, so you can put it up online. It's very useful.
Yeah, we'll post it.
Because everybody knows to put a wind and water barrier over the house, but they don't know how to wrap it when it comes to the windows.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to go a bit more sophisticated, you can take a look at pressure-balanced rain screens, where your siding is held out from your wind and water barrier by wood or steel ribs. Wood is usually less expensive, so that you have movable air in back of the siding. This is especially useful if you're going to use cedar siding. If these chambers that are produced by this wood furring are sealed from one another, you can actually pressure balance the wall so you don't have air washing through behind it, and you decrease the pressure on your wind and water barrier. That's getting to be pretty sophisticated, but generally, if somebody wants cedar siding on their house, we always suggest it to them because the cedar siding is going to last twice as long.
Oh.
Interesting. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, lots of great information there. Marty, thank you very much for calling. Jennifer in Madison, what's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call. It's not exactly a heating question. I'm just stuck on a project. I have two questions, one about my bathroom. I took the walls off around the tub and taught myself how to tile and resurrounded the tub with tile and took the opportunity to insulate the bathroom walls. Got all the tile up, and it looks great. I have the top and bottom of it lined with rocks, with river rocks, and then subway tile in the middle. I got all of the grout haze off of the subway tile, but the rocks were a little bit more porous, and so I wanted to use haze remover before I sealed everything. I used the haze remover on the rocks, and where that remover ran into the grout lines, it has turned the white grout gray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to seal dirty-looking grout, and so I'm wondering what I could maybe do to fix this.
Well, I assume that what happened is the haze remover had a mild acid in it, and when that hit the rocks, that took some of the minerals out of the rocks, and some of those minerals had color to them. They weren't just white. And so what happened is that transferred onto the grout, and then when it dried, it left this. I think probably the thing to do is maybe to try that haze remover and with a Q-tip or something, see if you can get some of that discoloration out of the grout. That may not have happened. That grout may be porous enough that it actually sucked those mineral colors right into the grout. So actually, it probably would have been a case where sealing the grout before you clean the rocks would have been a good idea. That's about all I can suggest at this point is to experiment a little bit.
Could you lay another thin layer of grout over the top?
It would probably delaminate, Larry.
Oh.
Now, there are some grouts, epoxy-based grouts, but most of them are acrylic-based. And you'd probably have to check with tech support at the manufacturer, which is another good place to call. Most manufacturers now have pretty decent tech support, and you can email them and say, here's my problem. But if you had to put in another layer, you would probably have to scratch out some of the existing grout and then go over the top of it.
Mm. Oh, boy. Okay, I will try that.
Sorry about that.
but we'll get her done. My other quick question is I re-roofed the garage last fall and put on a metal roof, which we'd never done before. But that also turned out great, except for the fact that the garage, it's a detached garage, the sidewalk that runs to my back door runs right underneath where the roof is. And so with all the snow we had last year, it shed off the roof all at once, and I had a big ice berm. And so I'm wondering if there's anything I can do to prevent that. I think about putting a gutter up there, but that snow would rip off any gutter I put there.
No, they make products for that, and they're just called snow stops. In Madison, there are several different companies that can come in and attach those to your existing roof. Some of them are actually glue-on. They have a tendency to fall off after a bit, but that way they don't have to make a hole in the roof. But if you call a couple of the metal roofing people in Madison, they will be able to provide you with snow stops and put them on for you. And the snow stops were put up, depending upon the pitch of the roof, they may say we need just one set, maybe 3 feet up, or maybe we need two sets, 3 and 6 foot up. But this is something that can be managed very easily with basically off-the-shelf products. They can probably, I think a lot of the companies even make snow stops that are matched to the colors of the roofing, because most of the roofing colors are a pretty standardized kind or sort of coating. So you can probably, if you've got a green roof that's forest green, you can probably get a forest green kind of snow stop that will match it exactly.
Fantastic. I went with white because of the reflectivity. Do you have, so you said you can glue them on or bolt them in, and I could see the limitation of bolting is that you put a hole in the roof, but it might be more secure. Do you recommend one over the other?
I really don't. I think what I would do, I've never installed them myself. We're getting to something where I just call the metal roofing guys.
Yeah.
So I would talk to whoever is there and then ask them, what's your warranty? If they fall off in 10 years, will you come and put them back on?
All right.
All right, John.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Bill in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I was wondering, if you have a house where you're coming and going for long periods of time, are there any thermostats that can be controlled off-site so that you can turn them up a little bit in the summer and down in the winter?
Yes, Bill, there is. There's generally, I think if you Google smart house systems, you will find thermostats that can be operated remotely.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. There's so much that you can do remotely anymore now.
There is, Larry. One thing people need to remember, and people actually need to look at their insurance policy. Some insurance policies say that you lose some of your insurance, if not all of it, if you leave your house below X degrees, and sometimes it's 50 degrees and sometimes it's 55 degrees you lower the, 55 at the thermostat, but where those bathroom plumbing pipes are, it suddenly drops to 31 and they freeze, whereas if it's 70 in the house, those bathroom pipes stay at 45. So let's be really careful when we lower the temperature in a house. The other problem that we have is when you lower the temperature, the relative humidity goes up.
Yeah,
and I was called in by a couple that went to Florida for the winter and set it at 45, and their entire basement was green.
Oh, boy. Oh, you do not want that. James in Eau Claire, hello.
How are you doing today?
Great, thanks for calling.
Hey, I built an ICF insulated concrete form house about 7 years ago. I did it all myself, and I thought that had to be the next revolution in building just because of its efficiency and that doesn't rot and the strength and the tornado and all the rest of that. And I just haven't seen it happen. And I'm wondering if you have any insight as to why that's not become more of a popular house building technique.
I think part of it is unfamiliarity and lack of skills. The last one that I looked at, it looked like a snake had laid out the walls. They had not been adequately adequately retained when the concrete was poured in. They started rotating outward. The concrete set. The guy just went ahead and kept building. It really was a bit of a problem. There's ICF and there's ICF. And if you take a look at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory testing on what are called these mass wall systems, where we've got basically plastic foam and concrete put together, how they operate really depends a lot upon the how the materials are placed. In fact, there's 18 to 20% differences between one ICF wall and another that have the same materials, depending on whether there's exposed concrete on the interior, exposed foam on the interior. So it is a little bit complicated. It's hard to find enough people who know how to do it. I think they, in some ways, they do make a lot of sense. When we do any design work on them, we put a lot of steel into them because we want them really to be strong, and that then starts adding costs. One of the things that we have at this point is with the plastic insulations that we have is we can build a super insulated house with pretty simple elements put to them, and I think that often tends to be less expensive.
That makes sense. That it, I know it becomes cost. It's still one of those where you look at it and you say, now how can people not really value that? That something is built so much more structurally sound and way over the top in terms of its energy envelope and the rest of that. But I guess my realtor said, well, when people are only in their house for 6.5 years, they want it big and they want it beautiful. They don't really care about how it's built.
And you did it yourself. If you were paying $70 an hour for the concrete guys and the form setters for that, you might have gone, I'm going to stick with traditional wood. But you were a lucky person that you had the skills and the ability to actually do it yourself, which most people, frankly, just including me, really don't.
Thanks a lot, James, for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg, our guest today as we talk about your home and its upkeep and its insulation. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about saving money and energy with your home. Our guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. Questions? We have actually have some open lines we can get you on fairly quickly. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And Sherry and Franklin, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, we had a new roof and very expensive brand covered gutters put on last year. And in the winter, we had terrible problem with icicles. And they put the vents across the top, and they close the other ones off. I'm just wondering if there's a lot of heat escaping and that maybe we should re-insulate our attic.
Sherry, how old is your house?
It was built in 69, and we've lived here 30 years, and we have not added to the attic insulation.
And you said they close the lower vents. Can you tell me what that means?
He said they put the air vents across the top of the roof now instead of along the board.
Along the eaves?
So there were vents down in the soffits or the eaves, and they closed those up?
Right.
Probably covered them with insulation, probably.
Oh, that's a code violation.
Okay.
Yeah, if we take a look at the Uniform Dwelling Code, which it depends on where you live, whether your municipality has or township has is using the code for re-roofing and repairs. But what the code says is that you need to have as much or more soffit venting than you have ridge venting. Right now, Sherry, your attic sucks. So what that means is that when it's warm, either from heat loss coming through the insulation in the winter or in the summer when the shingles are getting hot, air is leaving that attic, and there's no place for it to really come in. Now, it may be sucking air out of your house in the middle of winter. The other fellow called in, like the attic hatches or where you've got penetrations, maybe coming in around the lights. So I think that your contractor made a significant error and needs to come back.
Oh, okay.
The soffit vents need to be there. If you do not have the soffit vents, what's going to happen in the winter is that warm air is going through your insulation and it's in the attic because you don't have convection flow. You're creating a low-pressure area. If air can't come into that attic, that warm air is going to stay in the attic, melt the snow, come down to the gutters, and have an icicle. So it's very important to get those soffit vents reopened, and they need to have at least as many net square feet of opening as the ridge vent does. The second thing is, you probably should be adding insulation to your attic. The current minimum in the code, if you're building a new house, is, I believe, R44. I always suggest at least R50. And that, if it's a typical ranch house from 1969, can certainly be done with cellulose. But
it's a colonial.
It's a colonial, okay. But we have to make sure that we have the one-inch airspace underneath the roof sheathing so that the air can get from the soffit vents into the attic and then eventually out through that ridge vent. Let me, I think Larry actually has this on the website, but let me send you to coreevent.com. And coreevent.com is a really consumer-friendly website that tells you all about venting and even has worksheets so you can figure out how much venting you need for the house. I would take a look at that, call your contractor, tell him that he did something wrong and that he needs to come back at his own expense and reopen those soffit vents for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And John and DePere, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Say, I'm going to be helping my daughter and son-in-law finish their basement, and I've got a couple questions about vapor barriers. Now, he wants to do a traditional stud wall up against the concrete, and would the vapor barrier go up against the concrete or under or over top of the studs under the drywall? And then, as opposed to using your whatever mill plastic, what would there be an advantage to using like interlocking sheets of inch thick styrofoam over the stud wall under the drywall?
Well, we're going to run into a little bit of a code problem here in that I believe the current Uniform Dwelling Code says that you cannot use a vapor barrier on a basement wall. Right. So if you are going to be pulling a building permit in DePere, and indeed you should, because I believe that DePere is using the Uniform Dwelling Code for remodeling projects, which this sounds like, then you're not going to want a vapor barrier. Now, the reason that I believe they've changed the code, John, is let's say you get a little bit of leakage through that concrete wall. If you've got a vapor barrier underneath the drywall, that moisture is trapped back there. So what is going to happen is that moisture is going to go into the wood and you're going to get fungal growth and mold. So the idea is to let things dry out. If I were going to do this, I would indeed use the one-inch foam. I think that's a really good idea. But I would put it on the backside of the studs. There are foams and adhesives that you can glue to concrete. They don't work terribly well. But the thing is, you're going to be putting your studs against it anyway, so it's not like it's going to all fall down the wall. Make sure this basement is really, really dry. If it isn't really dry, think about using a treated sill plate. In fact, you should use treated sill plate no matter what. And then if you can put a channel and steel studs on top of that, that's a good idea. And then make sure you use a mildew-resistant drywall.
I was thinking of letting a small gap, like a half inch, under the stud wall for any, so if there's any water that would come in, it could come out the bottom without, sticking.
If there's any kind of history of water in this basement, John, I would put an interior drain tile in and put cactus board or some other collection system against the wall, so if water came down that wall, it went right into the drain tile.
What they have is they have on each end of the house, they have escape windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes when you get a pretty heavy rain and wind from the appropriate direction, you do get some water coming in there, but not a lot. It's just...
Okay, but that's an issue that you should have. A landscaper should be able to design those with a French drain system in and so that they don't leak. And that shouldn't be terribly expensive to do.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, certainly. Thanks a lot for calling. Alan in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm looking at attempting to put hydronic heat in, retrofitting hydronic heat in probably a 50-year-old house. I can access the basement ceilings. Payback on that, is that something that would be appropriate?
Well, hydronic heat. Somebody's going to say, what's hydronic heat?
Well, basically, we're just looking at hot water heat. The nice thing about hot water heat is you can get boilers that are just amazingly efficient. In fact, we have boilers that are rated 96%. When you test them, they'll actually operate at 98%.
Wow.
And you can use that same boiler to heat your domestic hot water as well. So you can get rid of your water heater. The great thing about hydronic heat, especially if you're like John and you're finishing a basement, is that can go in the floor and you get a nice radiant heat coming at you. So as long as you have a good contractor and you buy good equipment, hydronic heat is a wonderful thing. Now, the problem with hydronic heat is you need separate air conditioning. which it can add a little bit of expense. But many people will tell you that they feel that hydronic heat is the most comfortable heat you can have in your house. And people with a lot of allergies who don't want a lot of air moving in the house in the winter will also tell you that they like hydronic heat because they don't have all this airflow and dust gathering in the ducts.
We had some folks who were building a house out in the country, and they were, because of the home that they have on Madison's east side is hydronic heat, they wanted the same thing out for their new home that they were building, and the building, the construction folks were like shaking their heads and saying, "What? You want that out?" But they love the heat, so they love that their current house so much, the heat, that hydronic heat, that they want to take it with them out to the country.
It certainly can be very comfortable.
Yeah. Alan, thanks. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Patty in Wausau. Hi, Patty.
Yeah, hi. I have a home in the Northwoods that has lots of pines, oaks, and maples around it. And I'm getting lots of stuff in my gutters. Was wondering if you recommend any type of gutter guard.
You know, Ken always answers those questions when he's on with me. And I never have found a gutter guard that I've been perfectly happy with, to tell you the truth. There are some out there, like Gutter Helmet, that seem to work better. There's some things that are almost like slinkies that that go in the gutter. But the pine needles are such a problem because they are so thin. You know, you can keep oak leaves and maple leaves out, but how do you keep the pine needles out?
Yeah.
I have a lot of trees around my house, and I just go up, even though it's two stories, a high two stories, and I end up cleaning the gutters. I have not invested in gutter guards, but maybe there's something out there that really works. Larry, you've had them on your house, haven't you?
I've had them on my house, except I don't have any. I've never had any pine trees that would be in the way. I mean, and they do a wonderful job on the oaks and the maple and such. So I've really liked them, but I've never had to deal with the pine needles.
Yeah, Patty, I'm afraid you stumped us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. We have, let's see, Janice in Madison. It's your turn. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was calling in response to the woman who had the new roof and the ridge vents and the soffit vents.
Yep.
And I have the same age home, and I had a new roof put on, and they removed the old style vents and replaced them with ridge vents. And I'm thinking maybe that's what they did to her home as opposed to removing the soffit vents.
Yeah.
Now, I have the same problem she does with the icicles since we got the gutter guards and the new roof. And what I believe I've learned is that we did not have enough soffit vents to match what the new ridge vents did.
That sounds entirely possible. And again, this CoreEvent website that I think you can get on Larry's Facebook
page. Yeah, we just put it back up again. Yeah. Judith just put it up.
Good place to go because it really explains to you what is going on. And remember, you need the soffit vents and you need the chutes so that the air can actually get into the attic. I've been in houses where they've had the soffit vents, and then it was packed full of insulation.
Yep.
So it wasn't venting anything. So take a look at that.
Yeah.
Yep. We just had the Focus on Energy, and they all helped us put in new insulation in the attic, too. So.
Oh, that's great.
I trusted that they were very careful and didn't get it over the soffit vents, but now what I need to do is put in more soffit vents.
Well, I'm sort of Ronald Reagan. Trust but verify.
There we go.
All right. Well, I just thought I'd share that.
Thanks, Janice. Appreciate it very much. Oh, man. We have Larry in Tomahawk. Hi, Larry.
Hi. My question is, I just built my retirement home, actually, on the riverfront.
Yep.
And when we weren't actually moved up here at the time, so they went ahead and put in the footings and everything. Originally, the plan was to build it 3 feet higher than the river. Well, when they did the footings, they put them in level with the river. So I had some excavators come in, and the sump pump was running every minute. I have two wells in the basement, and both of them are running every minute. So I had someone come in and put in drain tiles around the house. That helped for a while, but now the sump pumps are going off again every minute. My question is, what are my options? I have no idea what to do.
Oh, dear. I would expect that since you're in Tomahawk, you're in pretty sandy soil, aren't you, Larry?
Yes.
Okay, so we probably have a lot of hydrostatic head pressure. I mean, that river, you can see the visible part of the river, but you can't see the invisible part of the river because it's flowing through that sand, and your house is interrupting part of that riverbed. Now, in a drought year, those sump pumps may turn off. In the spring, you better have battery backup. It sounds like your original idea of building it 3 foot higher was a very wise idea and one that you should have stuck to. I'm a little bit concerned here that you've put yourself in a situation where you're going to have to mechanically manage water that had the house been put at the proper elevation, you wouldn't have to manage.
Unfortunately. And we need to take a quick break for a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we'll be back with John Freiberger. Stay with us. We'll be back very soon. It can certainly be stressful when something needs to be fixed at home and you don't have the time, or maybe you don't have the money to take care of it. But sometimes letting it go can end up costing you a lot more money in the long run. Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Freiberger, of Freiberger & Associates in Fitchburg. He has some great advice to share. Always happy to answer your questions as well. And John, always a pleasure.
Great to be here, Larry.
I really appreciate having you here. We have a number of people waiting to talk with you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And Larry in Tomahawk, we talked with him a little bit before the news break about his basement issues, his water issues, and he's still with us. Larry, did you have a follow-up question?
Well, no, I was just wondering what my options were, other than having battery backups on the sump pumps. I understand that, but are there any other options I should try to explore?
How simple a house is this, Larry? I mean, is this sort of a rectangle, or do you have one of these Norman sort of houses that have got 53 different outside elevations? Is it real simple?
No. It's real simple, walk-out basement to the river.
Mm-hmm. One possibility is to simply have a house mover come in and raise that house by 3 feet. And then you put pea gravel in the existing basement. You put down Grace Preproof. You pour over it with a water collection system, and that should take care of it. You would be surprised how little it costs to lift a house. I've actually done it for $10,000. And then you can actually go right on top of your existing wall. You could possibly even use a wood foundation wall on top of it, as long as it's correctly engineered. That may be the best way to do it, especially if you want to finish that lower level room. Because the way it is, you're out there on a river in Tomahawk. You've got to lose power a couple times a year, and you're going to lose it during bad weather. And battery backup lasts just so long. So you may want to think about that. I would talk to a local engineer up there, a local architect, and see if there's somebody there that could easily spec that out for you.
Okay.
And that's really your other option. Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Larry, for calling. And actually, my neighbor, when we had on our lake home, the neighboring house, it was an older home, but a very large home, but it was basically kind of square.
Yes.
And they lifted that house up and put a new basement underneath it, or put a basement mm-hmm. underneath it. And frankly, I don't think it cost him that much money. I think you're right. Well, that much. You know, $10,000 to $15,000, still a lot of money, but mm-hmm. still, in the long run,
well, what you get,
peace of mind.
What you get, Larry, is not just the peace of mind, but then if Larry in Tomahawk wants to finish this lower level, then he's got a finishable lower level that he knows is always going to be waterproof and damp-proof. So let's say it's going to cost him $30,000 for the whole thing, but he gets an extra 1,000 square feet. Well, $30 a square foot, you can't build a white box for $30 a square foot. So it may be a good value. And we design many of these each year, either because of bad soils, or we did one down in Cambridge because it was in the floodplain.
Oh.
And we simply lifted it up, and now the guy doesn't have to pay that couple $1,000s a year in flood insurance as well.
Oh, that's the other issue.
Yes. I'm always talking about these 5 and 10 year plans, and guys have got to think about everything. We've got to look at what we're going to save. We've got to look at what we're going to gain. We have to look at our long term, what's in the long term interest of this house. Look at its eventual saleability, etc.
Bill in Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John. Picture a 71-year-old guy that retired to Florida, has a home down there, and all of a sudden he starts having grandkids up here. So I leased out my home, came up here. I've got a little bit of savings, and I started thinking about, I got a crazy idea to take some money and buy a lot and build a home. And I'm thinking, I'm a great believer in blending Eastern philosophy with Western technology. And, you know, in the East, they try to avoid problems. So I'm listening to all of these issues about mildew and radon and flooding and raising homes and energy loss, and I'm thinking, is it possible to apply some principles of simplicity, functionality, efficiency, accessibility, sustainability, economy, and build a little 3-2, maybe one-story home, maybe no basement, but something which makes a lot of sense from the long-term time-benefit-cost ratio standpoint. So I wanted your expert's opinion on this. Where do I start?
You start with an architect. You need to talk to an architect who does quality work, and there are quite a few of them in Madison that I can recommend to you. We do retrofits. We design retrofits on a lot of old houses, Bill. My own house is 1850s, and my heating costs are about the same as a house built in 2010. What you're looking to do is much easier than what I do every day. You have a lot of interesting books. There's a whole collection of books on small houses as well. There's a collection of books on energy efficiency. If you want, you could even look at a passive house and do something really rather extraordinary. And you can do that, as I think I keep trying to stress during this program, trying to get across to people, is this stuff isn't esoteric. It doesn't take really odd stuff. We're not building houses out of platinum and gold. We're using common building materials that you see all around you, except we're putting them together correctly. We're making assemblies based upon what we call building science. And there are lots and lots of things out there that you can look at that discuss building science and how to build a good house well. And fortunately, in Madison, there's also quite a few contractors who know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly encourage you to have some fun with it, do some reading. But this is something where you really do want to have an architect. Even if a builder has built a lot of these, work with an architect because things do change with some regularity. And those of us that attend conferences and are members of professional associations and things are doing that because we need to, because things are changing continuously and we need to keep up with the latest and best practice.
Yeah.
Do you build homes?
I do not. I do no useful work, Bill. I talk for a living. I do design work, and I do calculations. I work with builders. I work on problem homes. And the other thing that informs me a great deal, Bill, is I do a lot of expert witness work in lawsuits. So I've seen the 2,371,000 ways that people can screw up a building, and I've learned a great deal from it. I'm always happy.
I need you. That's what I'm trying to avoid.
if you would like to email me at frei@chorus.net, and that goes for anybody else who has a question, especially a question about old houses, I'd be happy to chat with you via email, and I can suggest some local professionals that you may enjoy working with.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill. Thanks very much for calling. Steve and Danbury. I had a comment about the lady who called in with a grout discoloration. He said that a lot of grout manufacturers make a grout colorant, which she could probably find to match the original color. Then she could continue with the sealing. But is that color mixed or is it applied on top of grout typically?
There are colors that you can apply on top. The question is, I believe that our friend said Subway tile, and Subway tile to me usually means white tile with white grout.
Yeah.
And usually if a gray is going to show up, it's going to certainly show up more in white than if she had a buff or a tan.
Yeah.
So thank you Steve, for the advice, and hopefully she's still listening.
Email from Jeremy in Muskego. What should one know when looking at getting additional insulation for their attic, total R value type of insulation, and so forth?
Well, I think you need to talk to a good insulation contractor. There are lots of insulations that you can use. As I said earlier, I like cellulose because it's a green material. It's usually mm-hmm. pretty cheap. It has a better R value when used in an attic than does blown-in fiberglass. My second choice would be rock wool, because rock wool blown into an attic is about R3.1, whereas fiberglass blown in is R2.2. Cellulose blown into the attic is 3.13, so just slightly better for the cheapest material out there. But let's remember, Jeremy, we've been talking a lot about venting, so make sure you look at that CoreVent vent site, that you've got adequate venting for this attic, that you've got insulation dams or chutes along the edge to keep the venting open, and then make sure when you hire a contractor that they seem to be pretty knowledgeable. You're going to gain a lot of information by looking at the CoreVent website, and if you talk to a contractor who knows less than you, look for another contractor.
Okay, there you go. Carolyn Hudson. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. We have a tri-level home that has a bay window in the front. And about 2 years ago, it was built in 2002. About 2 years ago, we had Focus on Energy come out. And then what we did is we had a contractor apply spray foam in the basement, at the top part of the basement on the north side of the house, on the inside, of obviously, of the basement. And I've noticed that our humidity inside is always kind of between 60 and 70 or 75 even. And I'm thinking that's kind of high. So how do we keep the humidity down?
Ooh,
and
wow.
That's
very high, Carol. I'm glad you called. What we know from building science research is that when your relative humidity hits 70%, mold will grow on surfaces in the absence of actual liquid water. So we really need to get that humidity down. Now, you're up in Hudson, too, so you're in a fairly cold area. So we really want a maximum humidity of 40% and maybe more near 35%. Now, you've got a 2002 house, and it's probably built pretty tightly, it sounds. You probably have a good vapor barrier, so you're not getting a lot of drying through the walls. Now, before they put the spray foam insulation, you did have drying through the ring joists. So your basement humidity was being driven out through the ring joists. But now that that is well insulated, you probably have more humidity in the house because that insulation was also a vapor barrier. What you are probably going to have to take a look at is a heat recovery vent system. What a heat recovery vent system does, they're also used to be called air-to-air heat exchangers,
yep,
is it takes the warm air from your house and it passes it over a heat transfer medium that warms the cold air that you're bringing in from the exterior in the winter. So this will put fresh air into your house and also lower the humidity. The other thing that you can take a look at is whole house dehumidification. If you look at Focus on Energy, you can see units such as the Sierra that are highly rated and have good energy efficiency, and this can be integrated into your existing HVAC system. So you probably want to talk to a knowledgeable HVAC contractor up in the Hudson area, and you can draw all the way from Minneapolis-St. Paul to find a good person up there, and you are probably going to have to mechanically manage your air supply in the house. Now, what you'll probably find if you drop the humidity with the HRV system is that your indoor air quality will be better also. You'll feel fresher, less stale air.
Mm-hmm. So lots of good advice there. I think it's going to cost you a few bucks.
Yes, but not as much as you'd think. And compared to a mold cleanup, Larry,
yeah,
it's going to be dirt
cheaper. A lot cheaper. Good luck, Carol. Thank you for calling. We have Ben in Fremont next. Hi, Ben.
Hey, guys. Thank you very much for the great show. I listen all the time. So much information.
Good.
The comment you just made. We put one of those. We have about a 1,600 square foot home and put a heat exchanger, or not a heat exchanger, but the air thing that John was just talking about. It was $1,600.
Yeah.
In and out. installed and everything. But that's not why I called. So I'm buying a home tomorrow, actually, that was built in the 70s. I had a question. It does not have a ridge vent in the roof. And they I noticed in our inspection that they have stuffed insulation blocking the soffits. Now, I know I need to take that stuff out by listening to you in the past. But I had one question. Without a ridge vent, and you were mentioning the ratio of soffit vent to ridge vent, you know, obviously this house with no ridge vent probably doesn't have a lot of venting out the top compared to the soffit vent. So that's one question. My second question is the firewall in between the attached garage and home is going to need some work. I won't get into that, but we got to take, it's not drywall, they got plywood on there. We're going to take that apart. So I wondered, since I have to take that apart, what would be the best and easy way to add some insulation, whether it be foam sheet or what, and then put the plywood back on. So those are my two questions, I guess.
Okay, well, let's do the garage wall first. What I really like on these garage house walls, because of the problem that we have with gasoline fumes and things like that, is I really do like to spray urethane. So I would go ahead and spray urethane. If it's 2x4s, I would then put an inch of foam on the garage side and then put the drywall over that. And that is going to give you a real energy-efficient wall. Plus, it is going to be airtight and it's going to be vapor-tight. So if something happens in that garage, like, you know, somebody kicks over the gas can next to the lawnmower, those vapors are not going to come into the house. Now, regarding soffit vents, if you look at the Uniform Dwelling Code, which, by the way, you can find online, at the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services, Chapter 321 and 322, what it will tell you is how much venting you need. What is interesting is, and we have houses that are more or less flat-roofed, is that if you have enough venting, you can actually get away with just soffit venting.
Hmm.
However, I think on your house, what you're probably going to want to do is go ahead and add some ridge venting. And the nice thing about it is you can add it any time because it's up there at the ridge. You don't have to reshingle the whole roof. But again, we've got this CoreEvent website up on Larry's Facebook page.
Yep.
So stop, take a look at that, friend Larry, so you get your updates. And that should give you a pretty good education about venting.
Perfect.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And John, somebody wanted you to repeat your email address. We'll post that up on my Facebook page, too, but go ahead and repeat
sure,
that.
Sure. It's real simple. Just FREI at chorus.net. And chorus is spelled like a group of singers.
All right. Fry at chorus.net. Robert in Shell Lake. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Okay. I'm here. I only had two short comments and a question.
Okay.
We had a new house built in 92. I designed the floor plans and all the intricate designs, and John Jederberg from Spooner contracted and built the house. And so far, I don't have the slightest complaint on any part of the house. But I'm curious why, when we have experts on your program, do I never hear about good or bad about stucco on the outside of houses? We have a neighbor's house that was built in 1920, and the stucco is still fine on it. And our new house was 20 years old. That's no question of painting and fiddling with the exterior. The stucco does the job beautiful.
Yeah.
And the other comment is not directly related to a house, but I'd like to point out to everybody, don't ever build a pole building with a ridge light. Birds go in there, they get stuck, and you find dead birds, innocent, beautiful little birds laying on the floor in your shed, and it's disgusting. I'll wait for the comments off the phone.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Well, thanks, Robert. Robert, I love stucco.
Yeah.
Stucco, we talked real early in the program about air intrusion. This is why we had stucco houses in the 1920s. In fact, it's why we had stucco houses in the 1400s, is stucco kept air from whistling through the walls. And back before we discovered insulation, we just had dead air space. We had to keep the air out. We put stucco on houses. And there's lots of different types of stucco. It's on wire lath. It's on wood lath. It's on this funny corrugated stuff. But we need to put stucco on carefully, and there aren't a lot of guys that know how to do it anymore. So what they developed in the United States is a variation on a German system called exterior insulation and finish system. Now, in Germany, what they did is they had masonry buildings, and they put foam over it, and then they put an acrylic that looked like stucco over the top of it, and it worked just fine. Here, we put it over wood buildings, and then we didn't detail it right, and then water got behind it, and the buildings rotted. So we have to remember there's a big difference between exterior insulation finish system and real good stucco. But I still do design work on houses with stucco, and I also specify historic restorations on 1920s, 1930s, to a revival with stucco. So it is a wonderful product put on correctly. It'll last 100 years. In fact, with the modern ways of putting on with an air and wind barrier and a rain screen stucco system, my guess is it'll last 200 years.
Wow. There you go. We have a Facebook question from Michelle. What are the pros and cons of constantly running the blower on the furnace? This is one that's come up before. My father-in-law likes to run it all the time because he says it keeps the house at a consistent temperature rather than having the blower cycle on and off depending on the thermostat.
Larry, in the old days, we had furnaces, and the blower motors were just terrible. They used a lot of energy. But, boy, these new furnaces that have these multi-speed blowers use just an incredibly small amount of energy. And I've heard a lot of the HVAC guys say that they would really prefer to see this blower running at the lowest natural setting all of the time for the reasons the father-in-law, I think, is probably right. It probably does add to comfort, keeps the air circulating. And if you've got a good quality air filter, like the Space Guard or the April Air, you're also constantly cleaning your air of the house. So if you've got some allergies or a couple cats running around, you're you're cleaning the air in your house at the same time, and you're probably introducing a little bit of fresh air because you probably have an outside air intake as well.
Yeah, so why not?
As long as it's a new furnace. If it's, you know, if you've got something from the 1950s with an old fan motor, maybe not.
Okay. Well, here we are, about out of time. Have you got, in the last 30 seconds here or so, any last words of wisdom when it comes to insulation or anything else?
Well, we always say winter is coming. Heating bills are going up. We saw in the paper that natural gas is getting more expensive. So think about when that cold weather comes. If you don't know how your house performs, let's go ahead and get an energy audit and see how it performs. And then let's start putting together our 5 or 10 year plan for maintenance, improvement, and insulation.
John, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great to be here, Larry. Look forward to seeing you again in December.
All right. John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. He'll be back in December, and we'll visit with him again. Again, his website, how to get a hold of him, his contact information, right on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Tomorrow at 11, it's time for Garden Talk, and Milwaukee-based garden guru Melinda Myers shares 6 steps to take this fall to create a beautiful landscape next season. Plus, we'll find out about her great new guide for Wisconsin and Minnesota gardeners. Stay with us. Lots in store.